Okay, thank you very much for the invitation from the organizers, which in my case came well in time. I'll tell you about a work done at the MagLab and the Florida State. I was supported by NSF and the MagLab, and I was extremely fortunate to collaborate with Jian Kang, who was a postdoc at the Magnet Lab. And he's here in the audience, so if you want to ask him questions, I invite you to do so. The talk is based on these two publications. All right, so as an introduction, because the principal character plate in the story is by electrons in graphene, let me start by briefly reviewing this physical system. There weren't really talks on this before, as I'm sure all of you know. Graphene is a honeycomb lattice of carbon. The distance between the carbon atoms is about 1.4 angstroms. And if you just imagine solving a simple tight binding model on this kind of a lattice, you will find a dispersion which looks something like this. In the Brillouin zone, there are two inequivalent points, K and K prime, where we have gapless Dirac dispersion. Of course, assuming there is no spin orbit coupling, which is tiny in graphene anyway. So now imagine you take two of these layers, place them on top of each other, and you rotate them by some angle theta. That's the twisted bilayer graphene. Well, if this angle is commensurate, you will create a new periodic structure called the Moret structure. And this new periodic structure is going to have a new wavelength period, which is going to be larger than the period of the underlying lattice, carbon lattice. And if this angle is small, then this period is going to be large. So what is going to happen to the electrons at the vicinity of the Dirac points? Well, they're going to be reconstructed by this new superpotential. And that's going to give rise to a new set of bands, so-called mini-bands. And now you can imagine filling these mini-bands by electrostatic gating and ask what kind of phase of electronic matter you would get. Now, just to get some intuition about what sort of dispersion we should expect to obtain, imagine for just a second that we have two of these layers completely decoupled, so just a theorist limit. Then, say the blue is the Brillouin zone of the bottom layer, and that's going to have two inequivalent Dirac cones, K1 here, at this valley, and then there's going to be another one at the opposite valley, which are separated by a large wave vector. Now, the other layer, the rotated layer, is going to have a rotated large Brillouin zone with its own Dirac point, which is going to land away from this Dirac point. And so again, imagine you don't couple them yet. You draw a dispersion along the line that connects these two points. Right? So the blue will be the Dirac cone from, let's say, the top layer, and the red will be the Dirac cone from the bottom layer. If there's no coupling between these two layers, then there will be no avoided crossing here. All right, and of course, this is happening at one valley to the degree that you can ignore valley scattering. The other valley will be essentially a copy of this. Now, on the other hand, if you start turning on the coupling between the layers, then there's going to be a level repulsion at this crossing and at this crossing. Now, this level repulsion is set by the strength of this coupling. That's some energy scale in the problem. And we can start asking what happens when that energy scale gets comparable to the energy scale set by the dispersion of the Dirac cone and the momentum distance halfway between these two points. So that will set the energy scale of this crossing. If the angle is large and away from magic, then it will be kind of like in this picture. Namely, this energy scale is small and the energy scale to the neutrality point would be large. And in that case, you will get a relatively wide band. On the other hand, if you imagine that these two energy scales start being comparable, then you will be pushing on this band from the top, and you can imagine starting flattening it. And indeed, that's what happens in a full calculation. The band does get flat, and that happens at a special angle. So to see an illustration of this, the left shows the Brillouin zone of this new superstructure. We are going to draw a cut that goes through this Moret-Brillouin zone that goes from gamma to gamma over here, k prime, k, and back to gamma. That's this cut. And what we're going to do is we're going to change the angle. So when the angle is quote-unquote large, so 3 degrees, then the energy scales that I mentioned do not match, and you should get something like a Wiley dispersing band. So the Dirac cones that I told you about, which folded in to the corners of the new mini Brillouin zone, will be over here. And so in this little simulation, the energy scale will be kept the same, but because as I change the angle, the Brillouin zone is getting smaller and smaller, I will continuously rescale the size of the Brillouin zone so that the x-axis just stays the same. So what does this look like if you do this for various values of the angle? It looks something like this. As you approach the magic angle, the bands get narrower and narrower, and eventually they get very flat, and past that point they get broad again. Okay, so that's the so-called magic angle. There are, of course, additional magic angles that happen afterwards, but the key point is that the band gets flat at a finite value of the angle, and as you keep decreasing the angle, the band gets broader again. Now, of course, this field has seen a major breakthrough announced at the March meeting in 2018 from Pablo Herrero's group at MIT, where they showed that in the magic angle case, when they gate the system and introduce carriers into this narrow band, they find, first of all, insulators when the chemical potential sits in the single particle gap that separates these bands away from the so-called remote bands below. As they fill it, of course, there's another minimum in the two-terminal conductance. That's when the bands are full. That's what you expect from single particle physics. But they also saw signature of insulation where you do not expect it from single particle physics, when these bands are partially occupied. And that happens when you would have either 2 or 6 electrons. Since we're going to measure relative to the neutrality, there would be 2 electrons or 2 holes per unit cell. And there was a signature of another insulation or high resistance state when you had an odd number of particles per unit cell. In addition to that, remarkably, they of course famously saw superconductivity develop in the vicinity of these insulating phases. This experiment was reproduced and extended, for example, by the beautiful work by Andrea Young and Corey Dean, in which they took, among others, a sample which is nominally away from the magic angle. The magic angle is about 1.1 or so degrees. 1.27 is not quite there yet, but you do have an isolated band. And the gray curve on top is what happens at 0 external pressure. In that case, you see a dip in the conductance at the neutrality point, but you would expect that if you had Dirac cone there. And maybe there are some signatures at the 2 particles per unit cell, but not much else. On the other hand, when they applied pressure, they observed the insulating phases develop at mu equal to 2 and minus 2, that's 2 particles or 2 holes per unit cell, and an additional insulating phase now develops at the odd number of particles per unit cell. So why is that happening? That's because the external pressure actually modifies the tunneling between the layers, and in fact increases the superlattice band gap and flattens the band before you actually reach the magic angle. So again, you have these two energy scales getting comparable, and that's what happens. Okay. In addition to this, they also saw superconductivity. There was also another remarkable experiment from Dmitry Efetov's group in Barcelona, where they see insulation at essentially every integer filling of the narrow band. And they also saw superconductivity almost everywhere in between. Okay. All right, so how should we think about this problem? We have the so-called narrow bands, the active bands, in addition to the remote bands, which are sketched here. Not including spin, there are four of them. So therefore, we can put 8 electrons per unit cell. If we ask what is the gap to the remote bands, well, from the transport measurements, the activation gap seems to be between 30 or 40 MeV. So maybe it's a little larger because it's a transport measurement. Now the bandwidth, at least theoretically, it's coming out about 10 millielectron volts, maybe smaller. Experimentally, it's probably larger than that. I think we still are waiting for a definitive experiment, but certainly from Alias Denning's STM data, when this is completely occupied or completely empty, the tunneling in there would give you about this much separation between the peaks. So probably this is the non-interacting value, or this is the value of the bandwidth we should be thinking about. And then the electron-electron Coulomb interactions for two particles of charge E separated by a Moré wavelength, so 13 nanometers at 1.1 degrees, encapsulated with boronitride, whose dielectric constants are substituted in here, so about 5, will be about 25 millielectron volts. So we are clearly in an intermediate coupling regime, which is the hardest place to be in theoretical physics, because we don't really have a good way to start from a particular limit. But in my opinion, there is a hint from the experiment, namely that the insulation occurs at simple integer commensurate filling of the four bands. And so in my opinion, that's difficult to reconcile with the notion that the insulation is due to a Fermi surface nesting or Van Hoff singularities, because such band structure features generically occur at incommensurate filling. In addition, fine-tuning with the angle or pressure, as we saw, suggests that the effective Coulomb interactions will dominate the effective kinetic energy. And so even if the physical system is ultimately in an intermediate coupling regime, perhaps a strong coupling approach may be more successful in capturing the nature of the correlated phases. So what does one do in such approach? In this approach, we would start with an interaction-only Hamiltonian. We project it onto the Hilbert space spanned by the narrow bands, solve the problem with the projected interactions only, and then try to use the kinetic energy as a perturbation to see which one of the phases get selected. And so that's the approach we took. So we're going to be assuming for now that the Coulomb interaction is much less than the superlattice band gap, which will justify projecting the Coulomb interaction onto this subspace, but it's much larger than the bandwidth. Okay, that's the hierarchy of scales we're going to assume is happening. Now, to proceed, let me set up false expectations. Imagine that we were dealing with a different problem, namely a Hubbard model on a square lattice, and we were at half filling for spin a half electrons. So our Hamiltonian will have a kinetic energy, it will have some interaction energy, Hubbard U. If we start from strong coupling, where we ignore the kinetic energy and just worry about the interaction, well, we can optimize this by placing one electron per site. But of course, we have a free spin. It can be up or down. So there's a huge 2 to the n fold degeneracy of this low energy Hilbert space. And then we would do a perturbation theory in kinetic energy to find out that the best state has anti-ferromagnetic correlations among the spins on nearest neighbor sites. So the key message of this work is that this is not what happens in the strong coupling limit for the magic angle twisted by layer graphene, because the Hilbert space spanned by the narrow bands is not in the atomic limit. So the outline here, that we're going to construct Vanier states for this Hilbert space. which will be exponentially localized in all directions. We'll then project the one over our Coulomb interaction, screened by the boronitride and the metallic gates, onto the four-band subspace, and then try to solve the strong coupling problem at commensurate filling. The answer that we get, this is perhaps a bit cryptic, looks something like this. The centers of the Vanier states are not where the peaks in the local density of states are. They are on a dual site, so that's why you're seeing a honeycomb Moret lattice here. So at two particles per unit cell, we found a state which is annihilated by the Coulomb interactions, which using an SU4 rotation that we found numerically, can be rotated into something like an intervalley coherent state. At one particle per unit cell, we cannot solve the problem exactly, but with a particular approximation that I will describe, we are finding a period two stripe. Now, if you were to look at the local density of states for this narrow band, this is already in the original paper by Pablo Jarillo Herrero's group, you find that the local density of states is peaked on the so-called AA sites of the Moret superlattice. And those form a triangular lattice. The density of states is not reaching a maximum at the so-called AB or BA sites. Now, it turns out, however, that the most naive expectation, namely that you have four Vanier centers sitting on this AA site, has problems with symmetries. And in fact, one has to choose the centers of the Vanier states to sit on the dual sites of the triangle and Moret lattice, namely the centers should be on the AB and BA. So one of the Vanier states, W1, is centered at the AB. Its time reversal conjugate in our setup is also sitting at the same site. So time reversal symmetry is realized on site. And then a twofold rotation about this axis will take us to W3, and complex conjugation to W4. So that's our basis. Now, not surprisingly, these Vanier states cannot be peaked where they're centered, because we already know from the Bloch states that the local density of states is peaked at the triangular lattice. So in fact, what happens is that these are their shapes. Even though they're centered over here in the middle of this triangle, their peaks are at the vertices of this triangle. That's the site. And so these are the objects which are hopping around. Okay. And as I said, once we have one of them, the one centered over here, we can generate all the others using these symmetries. How does it compare? Well, you can see it can reproduce the band structure. And the states are exponentially localized in all directions. So now we're going to be interested in projecting the Coulomb interaction onto such bases. As I said, in the physical setup, we have a twisted bilayer graphene sandwich between the boronitride, and then there are metallic gates above it. Now, interestingly enough, these metallic gates are at a distance set by several tens of nanometers. In some experiments, it's more. In some experiments, it's less. But 13 nanometers is the distance between, is the lattice constant for the Moret. For the Moret structure. And so if we imagine that these gates are comparable to that distance, then in fact the Coulomb interaction at large distances will be screened by the image charges produced by, let's say, a test charge sitting in this twisted bilayer graphene. There's an infinite sequence of such image charges, and it will be screened at distances larger than the separation between the layers and turn exponential. So now if we take these gate screen Coulomb interactions sitting here and we project it onto the Vanier basis, the notation here will be that the capital R labels the centers of the hexagons. The centers of the hexagons is where the charge has the peak in its density. The centers of the Vanier states are sitting on the dual lattice on the honeycomb lattice. Okay, so the capital R labels triangle lattices, and this little script R just simply labels the 10,000 sites that you have in between here. Okay. We find that the projected Coulomb interaction can be written to a very good approximation in this form. Rho here is a projected density operator, and then it's integrated over one of these hexagons. So now to illustrate the point, here is a Vanier state sitting with its center at this site. It's going to have three peaks at the three AA sites. Now imagine you compute this density operator overlap. Well, clearly, if I have another Vanier state, which is centered at the same site, there is definitely an overlap through this central hexagon. On the other hand, if you have another Vanier state which is centered over here, its peaks will shift, but there's still an overlap through the central hexagon. And that's true over here, here, and here. And so you can already expect that the projected Coulomb interaction will not be just Hubbard-like. There will be non-local terms in here, which we will have to keep. Now, there's a certain constraint here. In particular, Vanier states, by definition, have to be orthogonal if you perform the real space integral over all space. The integral here is performed only over the central hexagon. And so, in principle, the states which the states which are offset by one lattice spacing need not be orthogonal over this hexagon. However, they have to be orthogonal when you sum over all space, namely over these two hexagons, which gives you a relationship between the overlap integrals in neighboring hexagons. Now, there's a particular symmetry, namely a reflection about this bond, which cannot be realized locally in these in this Vanier basis. There's an obstruction to this, which prohibits these states from being either purely even or purely odd under this rotation symmetry. And therefore, the integrals in these two hexagons cannot be related. In other words, these states are neither even nor odd. And therefore, the only thing we can say is that the integral over here has to be the negative of the integral over here. But they're both of order one. And that's important. The overlap for the Vanier states, which are separated by this much, however, is going to be much smaller in the Coulomb interaction, because now they need to be orthogonal again over all space, and most of their overlap is coming through a central hexagon. So this term is going to be small, this is going to be small, this is going to be small, and this is going to be large again. Okay? So what we find is that the interaction has the following form. It's a square of an operator whose center is at the AA site, labeled by capital R, and it contains a term which counts the charge density on the vertices surrounding this hexagon. That's this N of R. In addition to that, it has a hopping-like term on these vertices, nearest neighbor hopping-like term, which change sign as we go from bond to bond. And then you square the resulting operator. The coefficient alpha here is of order 1. It's less than 1. It's about 0.7 for our construction. But remarkably, these terms actually have a spin and valley SU4 symmetry. The terms which break this symmetry are smaller in this expansion. Now, if this parameter alpha 1 were set to 0, you would have something like a cluster Hubbard model. But when alpha 1 is not 0, we will have some correlations among various sites. So in particular, this operator, which we constructed here, does not commute with an operator at a different triangle lattice site. Because, for example, if that other triangle lattice site is over here, they share this bond, and they therefore do not commute. So as a result, before we ever introduce the kinetic energy, even in the strong coupling limit, this model will induce correlations among various sites. And in fact, it turns out that these correlations are ferromagnetic. To see that, consider this sum of these operators throughout the entire lattice. We introduce 0 by adding and subtracting a constant. That's this n, which will be adjusted at the end. We find that when we open up the bracket, there is a constant, which doesn't do anything. In addition to that, there is a term which sums over all sites of this operator O. And it turns out that because there's a sign change on every bond, the sum of these hopping-like terms will actually vanish, and the only thing you have left is the sum of the densities in this cross term. And so in a particular particle number sector, the last two terms are fixed. So if you can find a state for a particular n, which can annihilate this operator, because it's positive semi-definite, you will have found a ground state. And it turns out that for n equal to 2, either particles or holes per Moray unit cell, this first term is annihilated by a ferromagnet. In other words, imagine you put the same Vanier orbital on every one of these sites in the same valley and in the same spin. Then when you act on it with this operator, you'll get two particles per unit cell. This hopping term is not operational because it's trying to take you between two sites which are occupied by the same orbital, and it can't do that, so this difference will then be zero. All right. However, as I said, there is an enhanced symmetry that these states have, and so this spin and valley polarized state can therefore be rotated by an SU4 rotation in spin and valley into a state that will have an equal superposition of the two valleys. You can think of it as an intervalley coherent state. And such a state will lower its energy by super exchange now in this manifold, because unlike in the fully spin polarized ferromagnet, there is some chance of hopping virtually back and forth on these sites, because there is a probability that this site may actually be empty of the particular valley and particular spin. Now, such a state, curiously, will have a total a spin S squared, which will scale like the particle number. And so even though it is a generalized ferromagnet, in thermodynamic limit, this moment per particle will vanish. We can't solve the problem exactly when we have one particle per Moray unit cell, but we can do it perturbatively in small alpha 1, in which case we find that the cluster Hubbard terms, the first term over here, will force three fermions per hexagon. But then the kinetic term, this strange kinetic term, the hopping term in the interaction, will try to maximize the number of bonds which are ferromagnetic, subject to the constraint that you need three of the six sites of the hexagon to be occupied. And the best you can do is to have two to be blocked by ferromagnetism. And so we found the state, which is a period two stripe. All right. And the Zeeman field would strengthen such insulator. OK, so in the remaining few minutes, I'd like to relate this. I have to make a relationship to a work which has appeared subsequently. So about 2 months after our paper, there was another paper by a different group, which was published in the same issue of PRL, where they have done something very similar. They used our method to construct the Vanier orbitals, projected to Coulomb interaction onto such Vanier orbitals, and collected some of the terms that I have mentioned. They didn't take all the terms. And the Hamiltonian that they found, this is a Kugel-Chomsky type Hamiltonian, looks like this. Okay, so this tau lives in the, loosely speaking, valley space, and this S lives in a spin space. Okay, they mentioned that this parameter eta that's sitting here is minus 1, so this would be plus 2 plus 2 when I and J belong to the same sublattice of the Moray honeycomb dual lattice, in which case the exchange interaction will have an SU4 symmetry, but it is of the wrong sign, they claim, otherwise, on the nearest neighbor sites. In other words, when this eta connects sites of the different sublattice, then there is a minus sign here as opposed to plus. Now, they contrast this to our results, where they claim is that in their case, the ground state is a product state between a spin and orbital sector with maximum magnetic moment per site. They claim their result is exact, and the prediction is of a unique spin-polarized ferromagnetic state, unlike what we are claiming, that the kinetic energy will actually lower that into a maximal spin-valley entangled state. So I'd like to take this opportunity to point out that if you take this Hamiltonian, which naively does not have SU4 symmetry, but simply perform a unitary rotation by 180 degrees on one sublattice only in this valley space, then in fact this sign will change back to plus. And then the resulting Hamiltonian indeed has SU4 symmetry. And once you have such a Hamiltonian, you realize that fully valley and spin polarized state is not the only ground state. You can rotate it using this SU4, and the kinetic energy will indeed favor a state which will be an intervalley coherent state. All right. One week ago, there was a very interesting new paper from Ashwin Vishwanath and Mike Zalatel's group, which has identified two distinct U4 symmetries in the continuum model, assuming chiral limit and the particle hole symmetry. Now, away from the chiral limit, but in the presence of particle hole symmetry, in the strong interaction limit projected onto the narrow band, so again the same as our approach, they find a valley polarized state as a ground state, and they use an SU4 symmetry, so very similar to what we do, to lower the kinetic energy of such state, and again obtain a valley coherent state. All right, so I presented a method for constructing symmetry-adapted, maximally localized Vanier functions, and the corresponding low-energy model for the four narrow bands of the twisted bilayography near the magic angle. As you saw, the Vanier states have three peaks around the Moret triangle lattice, but are centered on the dual honeycomb Moret lattice. And they give rise to an SU4 ferromagnetic insulators in the strong coupling limit at simple integer commensurate fillings. Okay. Thank you for attention. Yes.
Okay, so
yeah. So the way to think about it is that once you have correlations between neighboring sites, you are basically having an intersite direct exchange, which is of order U. And that's why it's connecting up into a ferromagnet. So it's very similar to quantum Hall.
I actually have two questions. One question is that at a half fielding, what happened to your state in the presence of Zeeman field? Because I think people talk about suppress of a correlated insulator. And
exactly.
Another thing is that can you comment on the superconductivity, especially the relation to the Dmitry Efetov experiment, like a superconductivity everywhere, almost everywhere.
Right. So to answer the first question, as I mentioned, our proposed state has a zero magnetic moment per site in the thermodynamic limit. And so that state will be frustrated by a Zeeman term. Okay, so we expect it to be suppressed by a Zeeman term at what you call half filling or nu equal to 2. As far as superconductivity is concerned, I have I keep an open mind on what's happening. I didn't say anything about superconductivity. There is a work on superconductivity using the interactions that I showed you by Andrei Chubukov's group, where they find that the interaction I have written down actually does have an attraction in it, and they use that to propose some pairing states with kinetic energy. But I think this is still very much of an open issue.
So in the flat band I know best, which is the Landau level, you can describe, once you project to a Landau level, you can describe the dynamics by understanding that X and Y do not commute and have a simple commutation relation, and that gives you single particle equations of motion that are very simple. Now, it seems that here you have this OR and OR prime,
yeah,
which do not commute.
Right.
Can you construct a description of the projected dynamics into a single band that will, just single particle dynamics, first quantization, that will be similar to this Landau level?
So we're in the process of trying to do that, yeah.
Is there a bound on the coefficient alpha 1?
It's probably less than 1.
Is there a hard bound at 1?
Hard, okay. I don't know if it's mathematical physics hard bound, but physically you don't expect it to be much larger, because if you, what's happening is that these things are really just overlapping through same peak in the central hexagon, and if they are off, if they're on the nearest neighbor sites, they're still basically overlapping through the same thing. You don't expect it to be larger than what it was when it was on site, where it was in this notation 1. So you expect it to be smaller. I mean, the, to us, at least to me, the surprise was that it's not much, much less than 1, but it was of order 1.
And for the strife phase, the cross term, the Tn term, cancels or what?
Because you, no, no, you're, so you're, I didn't, say, I didn't say it's an exact state.
Okay.
I said this is approximate for small alpha 1. So there what you do, just to repeat, we try to solve the term without the alpha 1 first, so satisfy the charging, and that gives us a constraint that we need 3 of the 6 sites occupied. There are, of course, many configurations that do that. Then you bring in alpha 1 through second-order perturbation theory as if you were doing super exchange. But you discover that, in fact, it's still ferromagnetic exchange. So then you try to block as many bonds as possible, and that gives you 2 bonds per site blocked that will lead you to a stripe with period 2.
Based on your model, can you say something about the size of the critical temperature for?
Of course, it's in the strong coupling limit. So as I said, we expect that the phases will be correct. If you are in strong coupling limit, then of course this will all be set by the interactions, although one has to think carefully through the fluctuation as well. So no, I would say at this point you would need to go into intermediate coupling regime to get a more accurate estimate of what the energy scale with the symmetry breaking would be.
So you got this stripe result after you included the hopping within the interaction term.
Correct.
Right? So I'm wondering if you, like, say, allow fluctuations, because you had many possible degenerate states, even with the ferromagnetism, could you get some kind of a spin orbital liquid?
Yeah, I mean, when alpha 1 is not small, I think that may be a possibility.
Okay.
But for small alpha 1, I think this is unique. Up to, of course, the SU4 rotation, which is actually, I agree, it's large, but it's much, much smaller than what you would have in a Hubbard model, where it's just exponentially large. Here it's just n cubed large.
Right, in the Kugel-Gomsky model, it's extremely difficult to get an SU4 symmetry.
Right. It's not exact. It's approximate.
Right, so that was my question. So
right.
Is it, how much is it SU2 times SU2? How close is this to SU4?
So you would have to ask GN exactly for the numbers, but clearly the largest term is SU4.
So I think the experimental facts are that the phases are not really reproducible. So every time they make a sample, they see something different.
Right.
It seems like, you know, even like mesoscopic physics plays some role. Do you see a room for this kind of zoology of phases they see
Yes.
from sample to sample within your model?
Yes. Because there's still a manifold of states which are nearby in a strong coupling limit related by these SU4 symmetries. So if you have single particle perturbations such as strains and et cetera, they may be selecting different, or for example, alignment with boronitride, they may be selecting different states from this manifold. So yes. Now, the one thing that I should say seems to be constant throughout this, as you call it, zoology, is that the insulation occurs at integer filling, simple integer filling, not incommensurate filling. And it occurs first at nu equal to 2 and nu equal to minus 2. It seems that nu equal to 3 is the secondary one.
So the last question. So if I complete your square, right? So if I take the square and then basically neglect either the alpha t n or the alpha squared n term, it still doesn't have an exact solution at one particle per. Right, so you have t.
Oh, if you just ignore it. Oh, of course. Then.
No. If you ignore. So you have, it's a square, so you get 3 terms.
Yes. So you just set alpha 1 to 0?
No, if I neglect the alpha square term, which would be alpha squared, alpha uh-huh. squared.
I see.
Or if I neglect, so there's two possibilities. I can neglect the alpha squared t, or I can neglect the alpha t.
Mm-hmm.
In neither of those cases, does it have an exact solution?
So I think if you just, I'm not aware. I'm not aware of an exact solution if you just keep that term. Yeah.
Okay. Well,